Lots of numbers, but what's the big picture?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm Mark Garrison in for David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. Now, a story about Fannie, Freddie, and Mel. Mel Watt leads the government agency overseeing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Those two guarantee most new home loans. Many want to reform Fannie and Freddie, but they can't agree how. That puts Watt in an interesting position to change things on his own, or at least try. And what he does could affect you if you want to buy a home. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports from Washington.
Mel Watt hasn't made a lot of public appearances since he was sworn in as head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency in January. His first major speech was last month at the Brookings Institution.
Well, we're balancing, in a number of instances, contradictory mandates.
The mandate to protect taxpayers while trying to get banks to lend more, but not make risky loans that Fannie and Freddie would still have to guarantee.
There, Everett.
After the speech, Watt hung around outside Brookings and chatted for a while. Not what you'd expect, especially since he's refused most interview requests, including mine. Watt was behaving more like the politician he once was. Watt served in Congress for more than two decades, representing the banking hub of Charlotte, North Carolina. In that former life, Watt worked with people like David Stevens, the president of the Mortgage Bankers Association.
I think he'll work cooperatively with Congress.
The Senate Banking Committee has passed legislation that would gradually wind down Fannie and Freddie, something Watt's predecessor also tried to do. But Congress isn't likely to act this year, which leaves Watt in charge of Fannie and Freddie's fate. But Stevens thinks Watt will let Congress decide what to do with the mortgage giants.
He gets it. I mean, Mel understands his role. He understands the role of Congress.
But Watt's role also involves dealing with a lot of money. Since Fannie and Freddie were taken over by the government in 2008, their profits have gone to the U.S. Treasury every year.
Even in this town, $25 billion a year is a lot of money.
That's Mike Calhoun, president of the Center for Responsible Lending, a homeowner advocacy group. I asked Calhoun whether all that money led to pressure on Watt, maybe from people in the White House who don't want to change Fannie and Freddie because they're afraid of cutting off the spigot of cash. But Calhoun says, nah.
They know he is going to be independent. You know, he's in his mid-60s. He is quite comfortable standing his ground.
Which is a good thing, because even if you've never heard of him, Mel Watt has a big influence over whether you can get a mortgage and how much you'll pay for it. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
France's president is blasting the possible $10 billion fine for French bank BNP Paribas in a letter to President Obama. The U.S. is expected to slap a large penalty on the bank accused of evading sanctions. The letter from President François Hollande is the latest in a campaign by top French officials supporting the country's largest bank. An arm of Walmart is making a bid to change how we use credit cards. Sam's Club is rolling out cards with security chips. They are common abroad, but this will be the first big American retailer to embrace chip cards. Kate Davidson reports.
The Sam's Club MasterCard will use what's called EMV technology. It's a chip that's more secure than the magnetic strip on the back of your card. Retail analyst Sucharita Molpuru with Forrester Research says this chip and pin technology has been the standard in Europe for a while.
European merchants generally have much, much lower rates of fraud than the U.S. merchants who haven't adopted this technology.
Carl Howe with Yankee Group says the big obstacle to change in the U.S. is cost, overhauling all those point-of-sale devices where we swipe our cards now.
Those are expensive devices, a few $1,000 each, and they have a lot of them. And there's all the back-end programming that's required for it, too. So this is not a small move. It takes a lot of infrastructure to make this work.
Sam's Club and its parent company Walmart are beating Target, which recently said it would speed its transition to chip and pin technology after its big data breach. But credit card companies want all retailers to adopt the technology by late 2015. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
25 years ago today, Chinese troops and tanks cleared protesters from Tiananmen Square, killing hundreds, some say thousands, of civilians. The violence capped weeks of student protests demanding reform. Marketplace China correspondent Rob Schmitz joins us from Shanghai to talk about the economic reasons behind the protests of 1989. Hi there, Rob.
Hi, Mark.
So most of the attention surrounding Tiananmen Square focuses on the students and the democracy movement, but there was, of course, more to it than that. Who else was protesting in the weeks leading up to the crackdown, and what did they want?
Well, there were actually hundreds of thousands of blue-collar urban workers who were also involved in the Tiananmen demonstrations. And some of these workers may have been interested in democracy and the other demands students were making on China's leaders, but most of them were more concerned with future economic opportunity for their children in an economy that was really moving away from socialism.
And Rob, there's so much discussion about life in Chinese factories now and all the products that we use that come from there. But what was it like for the average working person in China in 1989?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about China in 89 is that nearly everyone at that time made the same wage. If you lived in a city back then, you made a wage that was set by the state. It was very low and you belonged to a danwei, a work unit. Back then, the price of food and anything else was set by the state. But in 1988, China's government began to lift price controls in favor of the open market. And suddenly the price of everything went up. Inflation surpassed 18%. So the pressure they felt spurred them to join the students in the protests. Many of the people who were killed were actually these workers.
After Tiananmen, what happened to these workers and their goals?
Well, in many ways, these urban workers didn't do so well. I talked to University of Michigan political science professor Mary Gallagher about this, and here's what she said about China's slate of economic reforms after 1989.
It allowed migrants who were desperate and would have worked for pennies to squeeze out people in the middle. And, you know, when you look at people who protested in 1989, the urbanites who protected the students, those people eventually lost out.
And in many ways, urban workers in China are still protesting today. There are dozens of worker strikes each week in China. And according to labor groups, the number of strikes this year, as China's economy cools down, is up by more than a third.
That's Marketplace China correspondent Rob Schmitz joining us from Shanghai. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Mark.
And finally, soccer's World Cup starts next week. And as of today, there's a second chance to score tickets. Some 180,000 just went on sale, giving fans a chance to see a match without having to go through scalpers. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. This is APM, American Public Media.